Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz. I'm joined by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, we are recording this podcast on a sad, unfortunate day here in Israel, in Jerusalem, not so far actually from our offices. There was a double bombing today. We're talking Wednesday, November 23rd, against two bus stops, one at the entrance to the city and another a bit north near Ramot, a neighborhood to the north of Jerusalem, also at a bus stop. Two explosive devices planted there. The police, the Shin Bet, the Israel Security Agency, everybody's still investigating, trying to figure things out. But this is a clear, definite escalation in this wave of terror that Israel has definitely been in for the last couple of months.
Right. And now, while we're speaking, the theory is that they were coordinated, which of course makes sense. They happened one right after the other, but that they were set up that the bombs could be controlled remotely with a phone, and that basically Israel thinks that this is like a terrorist cell. So we've had a lot of like quote unquote lone wolf attacks. We had this like new lion's den group that was taken down within weeks of it being formed. But this is a return to, the sort of older style terrorist attacks that we saw in Israel before there was the security fence in the West Bank. And also, the bombs were full of nails and screws to cause maximum damage to maximum harm to the people standing there, which is also a second intifada tactic.
Definitely. That's one of the trademarks was that they would put that stuff in there.
Yeah.
You know, definitely there's infrastructure here, right? So you mentioned Lone Wolf. We had the horrific terrorist attack last Tuesday outside of Ariel in Judea and Samaria, where a Palestinian took a knife, stabbed a few people, then took a car, rammed one guy, killed three people. Those are much more difficult for the security agencies and intelligence community to thwart, because how do you necessarily get in the head of one individual unless they've posted something about it somewhere? But if they haven't, that's very difficult to stop, unless you're just on the ground at the same time that it's happening. Here, You need someone to get the explosives, you need someone to assemble the bomb, you need someone to smuggle the bomb into Israel from presumably somewhere in the West Bank. You need to be able to remotely detonate the bomb. There's a number of people, that's what makes this cell. And therefore, obviously, I don't want to place blame anywhere, but this is, if you're in the Shabak right now, you're asking yourself, where did we go wrong? What did we miss? Where was the mistake that might have happened that allowed these attacks to go forward?
Well, one of the theories that is coming from East Jerusalem, right? Because if it's coming from Palestinian towns in Judea and Samaria, like they have to go through checkpoints. There's the security barrier. It's hard to get an explosive in. But the theory is that at least part of the cell was probably in East Jerusalem. Otherwise, how would they have gotten there with the bombs?
And unfortunately, we've seen also instances in the past where Israelis have actually driven terrorists.
Right.
Unfortunately, there was one incident, not that long ago, but on Yom Ha'atzmaut, on Israel's Independence Day, in the town of Elad. Right. Remember, there were those two Arab Palestinians from near Jenin who came in. They had worked in the city. They were driven in by one of the Israelis who was then murdered with an axe. Right. They were brutally murdered on Israel's Independence Day. So that also happens. Definitely one thing that we can probably be certain of, Israel will figure it out. Right. They'll get to the people who are behind this. They usually almost always do.
Yeah.
But it's a tough day, and it brings back, like you said, memories of the style of attacks that I think we thought to an extent were behind us.
Yeah. I have a crazy story, but it was a story that made this terrorist attack it was a shock, but like somehow less of a surprise in a way. In July, I was on a bus that went exactly through where this terrorist attack happened. And after that stop, the stop at the entrance to the city, it goes into this neighborhood, Givat Shaul, and you have to go uphill. And as we were driving up the hill, I saw a bag that was on a seat that no one was sitting on. It. I called out, like, is this anyone's bag? Because I was like, that's not good. And no one claimed it. And I went up to the driver and I said, look, I think there's a suspicious item. It was a bag that had towels in it, but who knows what's wrapped in the towels, right? And I said, I think there's a suspicious item here on the bus.
Or as we call it in Hebrew, a chifetz chashud.
Right. And he stopped the bus and people were like shouting at me. They were like, what are you doing? What's wrong with you? I was like, what? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with the person who leaves a bag on a bus when we're in Israel, you know? Right. And to, but to me, first of all, the driver himself checked it, was just absolutely not what you're supposed to do. We're all supposed to get off the bus and the police is supposed to come. But that I remembered that. And I remembered it happened like really right where this terrorist attack happened. And it just showed how not vigilant Israelis have become, you know, like that they are not, weren't so worried about this. Because when's the last time there was a bombing from, you know, a suspicious object? I mean, it's been years. There have been bombings, but not like that.
Not like that. Not in Jerusalem, coordinated one after the other. It was almost surreal. You know, someone who's lived in the city during the 90s when there were buses that were going off, during the 2000s when there were buses exploding.
Yeah.
And in the 2000s during the Second Intifada, when that was, of course, happening all over the country, it was a total shock to see that happen again this morning. But, you know, I mean, we don't really need, unfortunately, and you know this, Lahav, to look for excuses or reasons why these things happen. You know, when there are left-wing governments in power, they attack us. When there are right-wing governments in power, they attack us. Anyone who tries to say it's because of this politician or that politician, this has unfortunately been Israel's story since inception, right? That's not changing, unfortunately.
Yeah, and you know, Lapid himself said that today, and I think it was a response to... There was a journalist on one of the big radio stations in Israel who said something like, oh, this is a response to Ben-Gvir. People Palestinians
right.
feel threatened then by Ben-Gvir becoming public security minister. And that she actually got suspended for the day
right.
from reporting because that was considered an inappropriate comment. But I think like Lapid himself also wanted to sort of send that message that like, it's not about Israel's domestic politics at all.
No, Israeli domestic politics can maybe influence the tone, the mood, the frequency,
right?
But the overall objective that these terrorist organizations have, and the people who they then recruit and enlist into their ranks, is the destruction and the death of Jews. And I mean, you know, when you think about it rationally, right? And we're rational people, so we think about it and we say, they can't destroy us. This is, but they can terrorize us. And that alone, you know, is enough for them to try to keep doing and to achieve.
Yeah. And then, unfortunately, today the news came out, or the IDF lifted its censorship of another really horrifying situation where an Israeli Druze teenager was driving and he got into a car accident near Jenin. And you know, a really, really terrible car accident. It was put on life support in the hospital in Jenin.
A Palestinian city.
Right, a Palestinian city, because that was the closest hospital. And his family came and was sitting by his side. And then Palestinian terrorists, armed terrorists, came into the room and took him off of life support, basically killing him, and took his body with them in front of his family.
And we're speaking, recording this episode, it's about 5 in the afternoon on Wednesday. His body still hasn't been retrieved. This is crazy, right? It's a crazy story.
Yeah, and I reported, I think I was one of the first, if not the first, to report that the UN is negotiating. They're working with the Palestinian Authority to try to find the body and get it back to Israel. But, you know, who knows?
I want to hope. I mean, I would assume that if this person was alive, the IDF would be doing a lot more, right? The question becomes, do you want to send troops in to retrieve a dead body that could lead to firefights and potential risk to the soldiers as well as to people who might just be out on the street at the time? So that could explain why Israel's been careful. But to me, and maybe I'm exaggerating here, but do you remember Madhat Yusuf, the Israeli Druze border policeman who was stuck at Kever Yosef, at Joseph's tomb, really in the beginning of the Second Intifada? And at the time, Israel decided to he was wounded and surrounded by Palestinian crowds and gunmen, because the border police used to have a presence there at the tomb. And Israel relied and believed the Jibra Rajub, who's a top Palestinian Fatah official, still today, but also then was head of the security. And he said they would get him out, and Madhat Yusuf bled to death. And Israel, that's a huge, I mean, so to me, it was also kind of reminiscent of that. Like, this guy's an Israeli citizen. His body's being held by terrorists. what the hell's going on? How are we not storming the city, right? So I want to believe that it has to do with the fact that he's dead and therefore not endanger other soldiers. But when he was wounded, should they not have gone in and taken him out? The whole thing is just strange.
Yeah, I mean, if it was a Jewish Israeli, I don't think that they would have been in that hospital to begin with. I don't know exactly where the accident happened. It could have been on a road that any Israeli could have driven on. But if it was a Jewish Israeli, it definitely wouldn't have been in that hospital in the first place. I don't know how he ended up in that hospital. I mean, you know, if the first ambulance that came was Palestinian and they said, you know, we need to get him on a ventilator right away, then maybe that's just what happened. And his family, you know, speaks Arabic and maybe thought they'd be okay. It's just a really, really tragic and horrifying situation. And I hope that we get the body back soon.
Definitely. You know, Lahav, in a sharp turn for a moment, but we do have to talk a bit about politics because that's still out there and there's still not a government and they're still fighting about which portfolio and who gets what. And Bezalel Smotrich, the head of the Religious Zionist Party, is still holding on and playing very, making it very difficult, I would say, for Netanyahu. He seems to be the thorn in Netanyahu's side right now.
The new Bennett.
is that what they're calling him?
No, but Netanyahu consistently underestimates like religious Zionists. I think he just sees them as like, well, they have to be in my coalition. They have no other choice. So, you know, with Bennett, when Bennett was the leader of sort of, you know, the Beit Yehudi, but it was Religious Zionist Party. Right. He would always like save Bennett for last, you know, and like offer him really like insulting portfolios in the coalition talks, like insulting in terms of his electoral power, which ultimately the irony is that ultimately Bennett became prime minister with only 6 seats at the Knesset. But that's, you know, that wasn't Netanyahu. And so, yeah, so I think he thought he could do that again to Smotrich, and Smotrich isn't having it. So, you know, Smotrich wanted to be defense minister. Now he's willing to compromise and be finance minister. But those, the sort of top three, right, are defense, foreign, and finance. So, like, he needs to be in those top three. So it'll be interesting to see. And they're talking now about a rotation for finance minister between Smotrich and Derry, because part of it is like, Derry's like, well, if Smotrich has such a prestigious job, then I deserve one too, which is interesting for two reasons. I mean, number one, Smotrich and Derry are basically opposites when it comes to economic policy. Like Smotrich is similar to Netanyahu, like very free market. And Derry is like very, very government intervention and wants more welfare payments and things like that. So it'll be really weird, like, you know, to have a year and a half of one policy and then a year and a half of the possibly polar opposite. But also, of course, we talked about this, that like Derry's been convicted for tax fraud. And that was only last year, right? It was the last year or the beginning of this year?
The beginning of this year. It was just
the beginning of this year. He was
10 months ago. Yeah.
Right. He pled guilty to tax fraud and resigned from the Knesset.
Hasn't even been a year.
Yeah. And then he's going to be in charge of the taxes in Israel. Like, it's bizarre. I mean, it's not actually clear that he even can do that legally, because
they have to change the law, apparently, right? That's one of the things they're talking about.
Well, yeah. So there's this whole concept in Israeli law called like moral turpitude, that when a public servant, like an elected official, is convicted of a crime, the court can decide whether the crime carries moral turpitude. And if it does, then they can't return to the Knesset. I think it's for 7 years. And in Derry's case, in his sort of plea deal, he resigned from the Knesset. And so they just didn't make a decision about the moral turpitude. And so there's like a question, but I think any ministerial position he gets, I think, is going to come back to court. It's going to be brought before the court. You know, so that'll be something to keep an eye on.
Moral turpitude just sounds like a bad disease. You know, it's like,
yeah,
the turpitude. No one wants to have that. but he'll get the government, right? I mean, Netanyahu, there's no other game in town.
I think so. I don't think that anybody in that, you know, in his presumptive coalition wants to be the person blamed for election number 6. Mm. Like, they'll just lose. I mean, the Haredim, it's a little different, but Smotrich certainly will lose his votes. Like, it can't happen.
It can't happen. Lahav, by the way, you know, I do want to talk with you just a bit about anti-Semitism, which is on the rise. And we have an interview today on this episode with Evan Bernstein, who's the national director and CEO of the Community Security Service, CSS, which tracks and tries to fight anti-Semitism and things like that. But before that, have you been following the Jewish food situation in Qatar at the World Cup?
Yeah, you know, I've been...
I figure you got something to say about that.
Yeah, right? Yes.
No beer, no... There's no beer and there's no hot Jewish food. I mean, what is that?
There's no hot kosher food. Right. So first of all, I wonder... You know, how much hot kosher food was there in China, for example? Like, I mean, there's Chabad in China, so maybe you could go to Chabad. But like, the thing with Qatar is, and I've been in touch with like Rabbi Mark Schneier, who, you know, for years before this, he was in touch with the emir of Qatar, because he runs this sort of Jewish Muslim coexistence dialogue organization. He'll forgive me for not remembering the name, but he's, you know, he's been like the Jewish connection to the Gulf for many years. And so he was sort of there, the point person for Jewish things in the World Cup. So he says that they never were looking to have hot food, that it was always going to be just like sandwiches. Like they were baking bagels there and selling bagels of different kinds. Tzvika Klein, our Jewish World reporter, says that there are other sources on the ground who said that there was supposed to be hot food, and then they said no hot food, like no meat. And so they were left with only bagels.
Can I just ask a question? Like, do they think that because we're Jewish, like that's what we eat is bagels? Like, is there some Qatari guy, some sheikh, who's like sitting around and saying, oh, we're going to have Jews coming, so what do Jews eat? Oh, they eat bagels. We'll make some bagels for them. That's what it is?
No, they didn't. The Qataris didn't like do the catering. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that it was the Qataris deciding that Jews eat bagels. But it is interesting to me that like hot food and meat are supposedly a problem for them. You know, like kosher meat is halal. Like it's okay. Anyone can eat that meat in Qatar, and then they won't have like the wrath of God upon them.
Right.
But whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it's good to know though, just in case you're thinking of going to watch one of the matches, you're not gonna be able to get a hot corned beef sandwich there in Qatar.
Well, you know, I think that the bagels and the Jewish food is the least of the problem, because, you know, thousands of people died building the stadiums. They have a horrific human rights record, and they
don't rain on the party, Lahav. Come on. Didn't you hear what the head of FIFA said, that he's Qatari, right? Wasn't that he gave that speech on Friday, right? Which was pretty awful. But they basically bribed FIFA to be able to have the games there, right? I mean, beyond the fact that they have a horrific human rights record, the whole thing is just weird.
The bright spot, to me at least, the bright spot in the World Cup, I thought, you know, I'm not like a big sports fan, but the news that Saudi Arabia beat Argentina even got to me. And it was pretty amazing to see the reaction, like how happy all the Saudis were. One of their players did like a double flip in the air after won.
Yeah.
And then they had like some top Arab, like a soccer commentator. I heard a recording where after he did the whole goal, you know, whatever that they do everywhere, he then was like praising Allah like 20 times in a row. It was like fun to see. Saudi Abu Samra, the flip Allah! No, I don't have anything against Argentina, but it was fun to see their like super excited reaction.
Imagine a Jewish Israeli broadcaster. What would they be praising God, or would they, if it's in Qatar, maybe they would just have a bagel. Lahav, finally, just about anti-Semitism, set us up for the conversation that we're about to have with Evan.
Well, I guess we should talk about some of the events that happened in New York specifically over the weekend and subsequent days. First of all, over the weekend, there was a warning that there was going to be an attack on a synagogue in New York, or someone was trying to attack a synagogue. Ultimately, the two people were caught in Penn Station before they were able to attack anyone. But that was when sort of we thought to talk to Evan Bernstein, CEO of the Community Security Service, who, you know, really helps provide advice and guidance to Jewish community institutions on how to keep people secure. But then after that, outside the Nets game, so Kyrie Irving is a player in the net, and he tweeted a link to a video that includes all kinds of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, like involving Jews and the slave trade, and that, you know, blacks are the real Jews. And after a suspension and an apology, Kyrie Irving was reinstated playing for the Nets this week. And there was a march outside the Nets game of hundreds of people from the Black Hebrew Israelites, basically marching around and saying that the Jews aren't real Jews and like, watch out. And it was, you know, in Brooklyn, not far from some really Hasidic neighborhoods. Really just intimidating people and scary to see that an anti-Semitic march is going on in the heart of New York. And we actually had someone from the Jerusalem Post on the ground there, coincidentally, and she had picked up some of their flyers that were really just spreading some of the most pernicious libels against Jews.
We got terrorism, we have anti-Semitism, and we have some bagels. But with that, here is our interview with Evan Bernstein of CSS.
So we're here with Evan Bernstein, CEO of Community Security Service. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure.
What can you tell us about the sort of planned attack on a synagogue over last weekend, and I guess what CSS was advising communities to do?
So on Friday morning, we received a threat alert from our partner in the UK, the Community Security Trust, the CST. We then promptly shared that information with the Community Security Initiative, the CSI, which is part of UJA. Their intel analyst received some information around the same time. The information we received from the CST helped round out some of the threat, the look of the threat based on some stuff that was on Twitter and on social media. And part of our memorandum of understanding with the Community Security Initiative is that they will then liaise with law enforcement if we give intelligence, whether through volunteer reporting of incidents or if we get it from one of our outside partners internationally. And that's what happened there. And then the CSI was able to bring it to law enforcement, NYPD and FBI, throughout the day on Friday. And we found out after, in the middle of the afternoon, late in the afternoon, that there's an actual investigation being done by the FBI, and they were using the intelligence that was given by us, the CST, to CSI, and it actually led to a full investigation and an actual arrest by law enforcement, which has, I know, been well documented over the last few days. And what the intent was, and there were weapons, and for us at CSS, not only with the intelligence sharing component, we actually had volunteers on the overnight. The arrest was made shortly after midnight from Friday into Saturday. And we were able to communicate with hundreds of volunteers on the ground doing shift, volunteer security shift at their synagogues on Saturday morning to be able to give the all clear that everything was mitigated and be able to do that in a coordinated fashion with the Community Security Initiative and the Anti-Defamation League, who's also a partner, to make sure that we were all giving the same information, the correct information out to the community. And that's where I think partnership and coordination is so critical. So often in the Jewish community, we see everyone kind of branching off and doing their own thing. I think this was a moment where we saw organizations really work together to make sure the messaging was the best and safest for the community. And how we worked together led to an arrest that, if you talk to the FBI and NYPD, was going to be potentially a mass casualty situation. And so it was really, thank God, it turned out to be a positive with something that was absolutely going to be a very negative situation for the Jewish community in New York City.
From what I've read in the media was that one of your analysts, a threat analyst for the group, Rebecca Fetterman, spotted a tweet that was what led the police ultimately to the arrest of this guy, Christopher Brown. And he wrote something like, "I'm going to ask a priest if I should become a husband or shoot up a synagogue and die." I mean, to me, it's incredible. A couple of things. First of all, that you guys, an NGO, are tipping off the police and the FBI, like, isn't that their job? That's number one. Number two is, people write all kinds of garbage online and on Twitter and Facebook and TikTok and all that stuff. I mean, like, how do you track all that?
So Rebecca, who's fantastic and works with us, she works for the Community Security Initiative, CSI. So, she helps us with CSS, with volunteer work. And that's why outsourcing is so important. And that's why You know, we are not at CSS Intel experts. We don't have teams of people that are scouring the internet and are experts in what to look for in algorithms. And that's really what the Security Community Initiative in New York does. And that's what the Center in Extremism that the ADL does. And that's why the CSS as a volunteer group has official memorandums of understanding, MOUs with the CSI in New York and with the ADL Center in Extremism is to be able to get this intel because we need that for our volunteers. Right. And that's, I think, important not to overlap. And I think what Rebecca, who works for CSI, is embedded into the Center in Extremism at the ADL. So everyone's coordinated and working together. And they have particular algorithms that they've used for years to help track these things on the internet. And when the FBI needs intelligence on something, especially online, and the ADL has its Center in Technology and Society in Silicon Valley, the ability for the organizations that are experts in this to be able to do their work, create those algorithms, people that are much smarter than me with much higher level tech understanding than I do, they have been able to find these algorithms that allow for them to spot these threats. Also, the CST in the UK also has a lot of this technology and some unbelievable experts. I was at the CST in the UK in March, their sister organization of CSS, and it's amazing what they have from an intelligence threat analysis center. So the fact that the Jewish community internationally and locally has this, it makes Jews on the ground much safer, and it allows for us as volunteer community organization to get the best intelligence out to our volunteers. And that's why the partnerships are so important.
So in the following days, there was this huge Black Hebrew Israelite march in Brooklyn that I know that a lot of Jews in New York felt really threatened by. And there's just been a spate of attacks on Jewish people in the streets, especially in Brooklyn, but in other places as well. And what has the advice been? I mean, and what has the Community Security Service done to help Jews, you know, protect themselves and, you know, avoid attack?
Well, I think for us, you know, volunteer security in the United States is a very new concept. Believe it or not, if you look at other diaspora communities, whether it's in Europe, Australia, South Africa, Latin America, volunteer security, volunteers leading their security has been a best practice since the Holocaust for well over 50 years, 60 years. And they work in coordination with local law enforcement, but it's always been the Jewish community that leads their security. After the Holocaust, the United States really decided to outsource its security to private security and to off-duty law enforcement. And now what CSS is trying to do is trying to really is flip that and try to make the United States Jewish community in the diaspora in the U.S. to understand they need to play a role here. And because of the threats that you talked about, and because we're seeing threats from the far left and the far right, and Jews are the ones that are left in the middle, we need to be able to be aware not only of these threats and talk about anti-Semitism, but actually do something about it and be empowered the way our brothers and sisters in the other diaspora communities have been for decades. And no one's going to care more about who's inside the synagogue than a volunteer is. I was on shift as a volunteer. I'm not a security expert on second day Rosh Hashanah, and private security did not show up, even though they were contracted to. So the only people that were there were volunteers. And I think we have to be aware that we know the community better. We know the physical plant better. We know it belongs better. And we're going to take it more seriously than someone that's getting paid. And I think as we see these threats that you just articulated, it's about for us as an organization to get into as many communities as possible to tell the story of the importance of empowering Jews to fight back on anti-Semitism and be those eyes and ears and report incidents and be a force amplifier for law enforcement. And I think it's still a relatively new concept, and we're trying hard to push it. And we these incidents, as bad as they are, in the threat level, as bad as it is when Christopher Wray, the head of the FBI, is saying, you know, how really bad it is for the Jewish community publicly, when there's a lot of other threats that he's dealing with, but he's talking about, you know, threats to Jews openly and publicly. It's important now that Jews understand they have to play a role in their own security, and they can't just be on the sidelines, and they can't just keep talking about anti-Semitism and the threats. They need to be empowered and do something about it. And that's what we're trying to do in Brooklyn, and we're trying to do it across the country.
So what exactly are the steps that are being taken? Right. So there's the intelligence gathering. You said that's a CSI, CSS. You guys are training. You're running volunteers all over the country. What exactly are these people, these Jewish volunteers, what are they empowered to do?
So for us, there's the three part of the tripod we see of security. You have the Secure Communities Network, SCAN, which is the Federations of North America. And the SCAN, we have an MOU with SCAN. And what SCAN does is they will have their people come in and they will do hardening the target. They help with grant work, stop the bleed, active shooter training. You saw a lot of that in Colleyville, Texas. And those security directors work within the Federation system and they work with synagogues around those communities. And then you have the ADL, who I talked about, and they have the Center on Extremism, and they're doing intelligence sharing. And that intelligence in working with the synagogues is critical. What CSS is that third part of the tripod, which is the volunteer security, which is building out teams. Teams that are going to be trained at a very high level to be outside of the synagogue and inside the synagogue to help harden the target. And if you talk to law enforcement, a harder target, having more people in the perimeter that are well-trained to be able to identify threats in advance, to be able to report threats to law enforcement is invaluable. Already this year alone, we've reported close to 100 incidents to our partners at SCN in Chicago in the duty desk and to the Center on Extremism at the ADL, and then they report intelligence back to us. So having those eyes and ears on the ground is invaluable because we're reporting incidents outside of a synagogue, we're reporting when something happens in real time when law enforcement is not there, or the security directors of a federation can't be everywhere at all times on Shabbat. And our people are there also to harden the target. If you have people in the perimeter that are force amplifiers for a private security guard or an off-duty police officer, it makes a target harden. And if you talk to members of our security council, and we have a security council at CSS that includes Mark Gardner, who's the former head of the Secret Service in the United States, and those people talk and you speak to them, most people, when they do an attack, they're looking and doing reconnaissance in advance, and they're looking to see how hard that target is. And if a target is hardened by the help of volunteers and working with private security and law enforcement, the odds of that institution getting attacked go way, way, way down. Mm-hmm. So for us, that's really what we want, is we want people to be able to be those eyes and ears. We're trying to create a culture of reporting incidents. There's so much that happens on it. I've been on shift myself, where someone tried to take pictures of our synagogue. And because our team was out there, we took pictures of the license plate, were able to report that to local law enforcement, were able to report it to our partners nationally. And that is something that can only happen if there's people outside that are trained and know what to do when those situations happen.
So I moved to Israel in 2005. Yaakov moved long before that. And from what I remember is we never had security in synagogue, except for on the high holidays when there was a retired police officer, an off-duty police officer, right, in a car outside the synagogue.
Now it sounds like there's an army.
Right. Now the threat level is different. I mean, I wasn't really scared of anti-Semitic attacks growing up in America. And now there's obviously a reason to fear for that. But could you give us an idea of how common it is for synagogues to be using your services? Like how many synagogues across America are doing this?
So we have not saturated the market, and we need to. We're right now, we have over 2,000 active volunteers doing security shift in 15 states around the country. We're working with close to 200 synagogues that have teams around the United States, and we need to be in more. There's over 3,000 synagogues in the U.S. So we're not close, and we need to get that culture of change. And really, a lot of it is it's a transformational shift. I think a lot of people still have the mentality and thought process of a golden age of American Jewry, the way that you remember it. And maybe just having that officer inside the car with a cup of coffee was good enough. And I think since Pittsburgh, in Poway, in Jersey City, in Muncie, in Colleyville, and now the threats we've seen, in New Jersey, and then over this last Shabbat in New York, it's a cultural shift. And it's really hard for some synagogues to really in communities to understand the threat level and digest it to the point of where they have to, maybe get engaged as Jews themselves. I still think we still have conversations with synagogues, even in this climate, where they are afraid of having those conversations. I think one big challenge too is, shul attendance in the United States was dipping within certain areas even before COVID, and you put COVID into the mix. You saw shul attendance drop dramatically. And I think a lot of synagogues are still thinking about how we're going to get people back into shul. How are we going to get them back in the synagogue? How are we going to get them coming on Friday nights? And if you start bringing up the security issues or threats to the Jewish community, it's another reason why Jews maybe won't go to synagogue, especially when Zoom now for a lot of synagogues became the ability to watch a cantor on Friday night, you light candles, and then you have your dinner and you don't have to leave for synagogue. And I think that's a real challenge for a lot of synagogues that we've spoken to. And I think so it's a balance of talking about the security components of things. If you look at Colleyville Synagogue in Texas, when the gunman came into the synagogue, they were doing Zoom services. It wasn't a full house. And yet those people were still threatened that horrific incident that took place with an active shooter, but it wasn't a full congregation because they were still doing Zoom congregational services. So I think it's still a new concept, and we're trying hard, really hard, to have conversations. And a lot of times it's individual conversations with the rabbi or the executive director or the board chair of the synagogue. It's not something that you just put a flyer out and then all of a sudden you get 20 or 30 people that are going to volunteer and go through a very extensive multiple hour training, over multiple days to be qualified enough to be able to stand outside of their synagogue and do shift. It's not just going to work at a soup kitchen or being able to go do, Habitat for Humanity. It's a real significant process and lift for a synagogue to do this. So the combination of the environment and what it takes to do it is it can be daunting for some synagogues. We're trying to make it as easy as possible and outreach as much as possible to these synagogues.
I just want to touch upon something that you mentioned before we let you go is the recognition that things have changed in America and Americans have to be more like other Jewish communities around the world. I remember, years ago going to places like Australia, you'd have Jewish men with, earpieces and standing outside on street corners, right? Europe, we all know to get into shuls and synagogues in Europe, you got to come with a passport, right? Otherwise, they're not going to let you in.
Yep.
Is that where we're at? Is that the moment in time?
That's what we need. And that's, when I'm standing shift or our other volunteers are standing shift, that's what we have our earpiece in, and we're communicating with one another, and we're able to, again, help mitigate those threats. And I think that's what we need. We need the Jewish community to look at what's gone on in other diaspora communities and take on that role and responsibility. The same thing that you saw in Australia, our chair of our organization was heavily involved in that group in Australia. One of our co-founders was heavily involved in that group in Australia. And that's how CSS was really born, was from what exactly you mentioned about what is going on in these other communities. Some of our most senior volunteers are because they came from the UK, they came from Europe, they came from those communities and said, we need to replicate what's going on there here in the United States. And that's really our mission at CSS.
So in Israel, I think people really rely on it depends where you are, but in a lot of places, people just rely on members of synagogues who have their own guns to be that sort of force multiplier. And we've seen many terrorist attacks in Israel that people with guns have been able to stop the terrorists. And in the U.S., it's a very fraught topic. I mean, when you're talking about Europe and Australia, it's like not even relevant. But in the U.S., it's such a fraught topic. So where does the CSS sort of stand on... we're talking about people trained to use a firearm, not just a random person with a gun, but bringing guns to synagogue.
Yeah, I get that question very frequently, and I'm unfortunately going to have to probably give an answer that's not going to satisfy the question. But we really don't talk about tactical best practices at CSS for security of our own volunteers. It's a best practice that our sister organizations don't talk about, and we take on that same. That same best practice. So it's hard. We don't broach the topic either way about anything regarding any tactical pieces that we use or don't use as an organization.
Evan, this has been a sobering conversation and concerning. But I think if there's one big takeaway, it's your call for Jewish communities around the U.S. to wake up, to use your services, and to join the CSS and the other programs and organizations that are out there, because this is real. And this real life example that you gave is just so concerning that you cannot be ignored. So we thank you very much for all you do. And we thank you for your time for joining us.
No, I thank you both. And I really appreciate you having me on and be able to talk about volunteer security. It means a lot and we really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. You can find us, as always, on all different players of podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Apple. And of course, have a great and happy Thanksgiving holiday.